Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Midpoint with me, Gabby Logan. My guest today is one of the nation's most recognisable petrol heads, best known for presenting Top Gear for over a decade, a show that's brought joy to millions. It's Richard Hammond. In many people's eyes, he had the best job in the world, driving fast cars, travelling the world and competing in ridiculous challenges with his friends. But there was a dark side, and in 2006, Richard was involved in a serious accident. To say he's lucky to be alive is an understatement. The high-speed jet-powered car he was piloting crashed at 319 miles per hour. He sustained a brain injury, which he says has never really left him. But rather than dwell on that, Richard says it's part of who he is today, a topic he explores in his podcast, Who We Are Now, which he presents alongside his daughter, Izzy. And I'm keen to hear more about the journey he's been on for the last 18 years and why the accident hasn't stopped him from embracing all the perils that fast vehicles bring whilst filming the Grand Tour since 2015. So here he is. Please welcome Richard Hammond. Welcome to The Midpoint. How are you? How do I find you today?
Very well indeed. Thank you for having me on. You find me all right. I'm well.
Good. Embarking on new projects and tackling new things, which is great in midlife. It's the one thing I think we all realise we need to do is just keep the grey matter going into new areas, learning new things. So tell us, let's start off straight away, shall we, about this new podcast you're doing with your daughter, Izzy.
Well, it's rooted in a similar desire to yours, Gabby, actually. But from my own point of view, as a man, what am I, 54, life throws up certain things which we share, which are in common. Actually, that's a really good point. For instance, in my life, big issues, marriage, jobs, daughters arriving, and I had a big brain injury. And that became, it's a big life moment. And one of the weird things about that, recovery from a frontal lobe brain injury, however it's been acquired, is a very similar path. So I've spoken at length with people who've been brain injured, being shot at by somebody else trying to kill them, or fallen off a ladder cleaning a window. And yet the path to recovery is very similar. And I think similar to that, midlife, there's huge differences in each of our individual experiences of it, but there's huge commonalities, the ways we have to deal with them, the nature of them. The specifics can be very different, but the nature of the things that come at you in midlife, the challenges you face. So that was one of the things I wanted to deal with. But also, I think it's very difficult to know how to be a bloke and a middle-aged bloke now. The world changes and you're left thinking, am I doing this right or am I doing it wrong? And again, sorry, I do talk a lot.
It's perfect.
It's a podcast. To the same point, I think middle-aged men, we're just one slice, one demographic in a broader society, just as middle-aged women, menopausal women, young girls, old men. We're each of us just one part of society. But society as a whole needs each of those demographics to be at their best. So, we're just a bunch of middle-aged men, but society needs good, mentally healthy middle-aged men. So I wanted to tackle some of those things in a podcast where you can enjoy talking at length. And my daughter, Izzy, joined in a sort of production role. But we very quickly began realizing as we were going through ideas and laying out plans that, weirdly, just looking at the world through the eyes of a 54-year-old man, well, that's not how the world is it? Mm. And 54-year-old men need to relate to a broader society. So Izzy's views were very useful as we went through production. To the point, we thought, well, why don't you just come on it? And then you can stop me turning it into an echo chamber where two middle-aged men are moaning about the price of things and how young policemen are these days by saying, oh, do shut up, and keep us on track. And that's what it's turned into. So it's kind of looking at the world through a 54-year-old man's eyes, but sometimes through those of a 23-year-old girl who knows him well enough to call him out. If she thinks I'm talking rubbish, she doesn't hesitate to stop me.
And has she turned out to be a natural broadcaster?
Yeah. Oh, she has. Yeah, because she's grown up with it. It's all she's ever known. I was doing Top Gear when she was born, and I'd already been in the media for 15 years before that. It's all I've ever done.
So she's very savvy.
Yeah, but she's also not remotely fazed by it. If there's a camera around, well, yeah, there always is, or a microphone. It doesn't... So what she doesn't do is immediately, oh, look, it's me, I'm going to be famous. She's not really interested in that. She's interested in the subject that we're talking about and will lose herself in the conversation, which is exactly what we as broadcasters need to do.
And has it been fun for you working with her?
Yeah, it's amazing. I love it. I'm going to say she's good because she's my daughter. But in all I can do is, I'm very lucky. I've done this for long enough. I can open a door, or you know, she can have this opportunity. But she's on the show not to give her an opportunity. She's on the podcast because actually her viewpoint is valid and her contribution valuable. Frankly, she wouldn't want to do it if it weren't, because she's not, as I say, a fame-hungry youth. She's not remotely interested. She doesn't care how she
What
looks.
Did she want to do before she started doing
She podcasting? Just graduated from Bristol University with a first in English. She didn't know. She'd never had any interest in cars or broadcasting, because it's all I've ever done. But she's suddenly shown an interest, and I've said, well, all right, step in, but you're on your own, kid. I can't do you've got to do it. Mm-hmm. You'll sink or swim according to your own abilities. And she's getting on with it and loving it.
So just take us back a step when you said at the very beginning of your explanation of why the podcast came to be. And it's interesting because middle-aged men and middle-aged white men from a certain kind of background as well would feel perhaps in this world sometimes that everybody else is, you know, coming for them almost. And when you look back at your kind of career and the things that you were doing, say, 20, 30 years ago or 20 years ago on telly, certainly, landscape's changed a bit, hasn't it? And perhaps those programmes and the way they were presented would be different now.
Yes, but I think, you could view that as, you know, persecution of, well, me, pale, stale male. But equally, I think I'm a great believer in representation, and I really think it's a powerful and potent thing. Nobody feels able to join in a conversation or visit a place, whether that's in the media or physically for real, until they see somebody like them there. And I totally feel
Were you aware
that.
Of that, though, at the time? When you
No.
look back and you realise how unrepresentative, perhaps, telly was, and not just your area, you know, back in the late 90s,
no, I'd say not. I mean, I started in radio in 1988, though, to be fair, in about 1999 or something, I was going for a job interview and the interviewer said to me, yeah, great, but how would you feel about working for a woman? And I stopped and thought for quite a while and went through everything I'd ever done. I thought, I've only ever worked for women. All of my bosses had been women. It had never occurred to me.
But you asked that question
that.
Even. Somebody asked.
Yeah. Because it was a different time. But I do think, back to the point of representation, I think the media has a tremendous job, and it is happening. I think the way different demographic groups, different personality types, genders, races, whatever the things that divide or that differ between us, until you, whichever little tiny group you conform to, until you see them represented in the media, you won't feel empowered to join in and be part of it. So I think it's not a pendulum swinging the other way. It's not society exercising revenge on pale, stale males. It's not about that, because how could you have... You can't have revenge. It doesn't really exist. It's just a feeling. It's about representation. It's about everybody feeling, oh, yeah, I can have a role to play in that, or I can join in that conversation. And I think it's very, very important that it happens.
But it's also important, isn't it, for people to understand where other people are coming from in terms of how we make big decisions in society and how we grow and develop and are creative. And, you know, the idea that you'd have a board that would just look the same, you know, the same aged people coming from the same background, you're just not going to get the thought processes and the creativity that you need.
No, we also need to be careful to include everybody in on those key conversations. I mean, yeah, I'm talking, you know, from the point of view that I can only give you the view of a middle-aged of me, because that's where I live and I see out of those. Mm. But I'm very happy to try and see through others and understand them. But each of us has our own contribution to make. Society isn't siloed. We all exist together. Big conversations taking place around menopause, and I think that's absolutely tremendous. But something I heard a while back, it being discussed on Radio 4, Woman's Hour, and I'm often on the motorway when Woman's Hour is on. And I'll always put it on because, yeah, I'm not a woman, but women make up more than 50% of my world. I mean, I'm married to a woman, I have two daughters, but equally, whoever you are, if you're a man, at least half of the people in your life
will be women.
Are going to be women. Now, that doesn't... Okay, that's not just straight married men. It's all men, because society is half female. So they were talking about the menopause, and there was a conversation going on. But early on, they said, we're talking about the menopause today. Great. And then said, yes, so there's no men on. And they laughed. And then there was a woman talking about, saying, yeah, well, you know, menopause struck. She'd been a high-powered businesswoman, lost her job. Well, she'd given up her job. And the husband, he went. And they all laughed and carried on. And I thought, wait a minute. There's a bloke there that needs to understand what's happened, because I'm never going to have the menopause, and I'm lucky. But half the people I know are, and I have a role to play in supporting them, in understanding, and they have a role to play in my life.
So did you bring that conversation up with your wife when you actually heard that?
Yeah, we've spoken about, we speak about menopause. Mm. Mindy will speak about anything with me. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
You got more informed and
Yeah, I want to know what I can do to help. Mm-hmm. We evolved a great technique. Mindy would, there would be times when you could see it was hellish for her. Really difficult being in there. And it's not her fault, it's what's going on. But occasionally she turned to me and just, have I been a bit, yeah, you have. And that was enough. And that's because, and this is why, if something affects half of society, it affects all of society. And I needed Mindy to know, for my male pride, if she'd been really, struggling that week, I don't want revenge on her for that. It's not her fault. It's hormones driving her through that. It's not willful. But I also needed to signal her to her, without saying it, I'm not a complete doormat. I don't really want to be treated like that all the time, but I fully acknowledge it's not your fault that that is happening at the moment. So it was quite important for both of us that that could be acknowledged, didn't have to be discussed, unpacked. Wasn't my business to go into where her mind is, other than that she's half my life. Mm. In the same way that, men are half of the people that women know are going to be men. So we all need to be on our best game. So I think anything we can do as middle-aged men to provide society with useful, functioning, balanced, thoughtful middle-aged men is actually a contribution to a broader society than just to ourselves.
Were there things that you were thinking and ways that your brain was working before you approached the podcast idea and got going on it, that you thought, I need to have another angle on this. I need somebody else's, and you talked about being in a silo, I need somebody else's take on this. I'm in danger. Because sometimes I think, even though I like to think I'm kind of well-read and I've got lots of different opinions coming at me, you sometimes think, why do I feel like this about this particular topic? I need to hear somebody else's side on it to try and balance that. Were you aware of that becoming more and more your kind of default?
It happened through the process of designing what we were going to talk about. And as I say, then Izzy, as my daughter, stepped in to be part of it, because she has, not only the right to call me out, but also she knows me well enough to know when, hang on, wait a minute, I'm going to challenge your view behind that. What are you really thinking? That's important.
And what's changed for you then? What do you think that, in terms of your conversations you've had so far, have you moved the dial on anything or changed your opinion on something?
Yes. I think most definitely. I think there's been, I think the stereotypes about, men not being happy talking about feelings and things, that's falling away. I'm realising that they do. I had reached a point where I thought, some of the ways in which I thought life was probably easier for a younger man now than it was when I was a young man, I think it's harder. In other ways, I think it's easier. I mean, young men are under a great deal more pressure to conform visually to a supposed norm than ever. When I was a kid, it just didn't matter. When I was 18, bloke was a bloke, wasn't it? It didn't matter. Women were under all the pressure to look a certain way. So I think young blokes are under a lot more pressure that way. But equally, they're under a lot less pressure to conform to a stereotypical or a male stereotype that I was expected to conform to and didn't want to. I'm not particularly laddish. I never really followed football.
You do like hinges.
Yeah, that's quite male. Well, is it?
Well, no, but that's the stereotype I'm saying. That's the kind of...
I suppose I did, but I wasn't... I, 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 we had to be something that we didn't necessarily want to be, and we couldn't be something when we wanted to be vulnerable, when we wanted to be just present and engaged. And I watch Izzy with, when she was younger, she was 17, 18, with a bunch of her friends. There was nothing unusual about a bloke going shopping with a load of his girlfriends in the day and then going out in the evening with them. He didn't have to be predatory. He didn't have to be peacocking around or starting a bar fight. He could just have a chat with his mates. Mm. And that was lovely. And I did watch and think, God, I never had the opportunity to do that as a young man, and I would have loved it. The opportunity to be sometimes present in the world as a softer, nicer person.
Yeah. Because you were in such a, you know, thinking back to the heydays of Top Gear before the Grand Tour, and that was such a machismo environment.
That gets levelled at us so often.
Well, it appeared to be very...
Exactly. Sensitive. But think about it. How was it? I've had people say to me, oh, yeah, I know what you lot are like about women and parking. What? What have we ever... When have we said that? People...
I'm not saying
projected...
it was anti-women, but it was quite a... it looked a very male space. You know,
it never
even
felt
just
it.
Gazing in as a female.
Never felt it. It had a 49 to 50% female audience.
But yeah, I mean, I was watching, so that, you know, so therefore I'm kind of contradicting myself on the one hand, but I felt like I was looking in as a woman into, and not that it bothered me, but there was blokes having a nice time with blokes, but and their humour and the cruel nature, I suppose, of that humour sometimes with each other, you probably wouldn't see in a female space, which probably set it apart in a slightly...
Do you not watch Loose Women? It's fantastic. I love that they now that they will do that. But you're right. I think an element of the show's appeal was because it gave an insight into what three ordinary... I mean, look at us. We're not exactly triangular torso snake-hipped heroes, are we? We're not ideal. We're quite approachable and accessible, and you can empathise with us. And I think we were providing an insight into what three actually not particularly laddish or machismo blokes get up to if left to their own devices. Yes. But what it wasn't was an unapproachable, exclusive, macho, laddish culture. It wasn't. It was a bunch of really quite pleasant people just having fun.
It wouldn't have lasted as long if it was...
Yeah, if that had been at the heart of it.
Yeah, no. I mean, it had to, and as you say, had to appeal to, sitting where it did in the schedules, had to appeal to a female audience as well.
Well, I think that's one of the things that defined the show, because when we first started it, when I was a kid, Top Gear was always on a Thursday night. And when I got the job, I thought, brilliant, I'm going to be on telly every Thursday. I mean, I'd been doing car shows, but little tiny ones. And I thought it'd be on a Thursday. And then when they told us it was on a Sunday night, I remember thinking, well, nothing goes out. What are we, Songs of Praise? Nothing goes out on a Sunday night. Because it wasn't really a slot. But then, of course, it is the last slot, the last thing a lot of families watched before work or school the next day. So that probably helped.
Well, it's the Strictly Results show slot, basically, isn't it? You know,
I mean, and Andy Wilman, the legendary producer-editor, he is the fourth musketeer and really the defining character. That without him, there is no show. He reckoned that was it, because a lot of mothers would join because the whole family was happy to sit down and watch TV together on a Sunday night before work and school. And we were in that slot. And then the mothers would find, actually, my husband's a bit like that. He's as big an idiot as they are with his mates. So I think that we were the beneficiaries of that slot. It did us a favour.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you look back now, and you've referred to your brain injury and your accident, when you look back now, can you believe that you were doing those things? I don't think there's anywhere at the moment on television that pushes the boundaries in quite that way. Gladiators doesn't, does it?
Oh, superb. I love that. I love that they brought that back. I think it's superb.
Well, it's done really, amazingly really well. There's an appetite for it, clearly.
Because people... I mean, just a slight aside, because I did Total Wipeout for quite a while on BBC.
Forgot you did that, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. More thought went into that show than just about anything I've ever done, even though it was completely bonkers. But in terms of making it work, the sort of nuance of it, the attitude of it, I loved it. Because I remember when I was asked to do it and it was described to me and I said, well, no, why would I do that? It's ridiculous. And then the boss of BBC One, she sent me the DVD of it and I watched it and thought, oh, yeah, I want to do that.
I'm in.
But, yeah, but there's a few rules. I want to model my role more like dear old Terry Wogan's was on the Eurovision. It's just something that they're doing. It's as though it's broken out and I'm there just kind of...
passing comment.
There it is. Yeah. So it was, I really wanted a rule book for it. I never said, this week we're doing that. It was always, this week they've got this game. The only difference between you and me as a viewer and me as the host was that I had the names written down on a piece of paper. That was it. So I'm sort of on the sofa with you watching it, often laughing at the ridiculousness of what they're being asked. I loved that show. But I think there was a big role for those to play.
But going back to what the original part of that question, sorry, it was my fault because I brought up Gladiators, but does it look to you now like, oh my gosh, we wouldn't be able to make that show how we did now? The boundaries that were set.
We weren't gung-ho. We really weren't. And we had everything in place if it did go wrong. And you know, it did for me, but that was a tire blew. Nobody's going to know that. It blew at 320 miles an hour, which is a problem.
Think about the risks, though, before it. Did you weigh things up?
Yes, and I still do think about the risks. But, you know, as long as we've done everything we can to mitigate against anything going wrong, or in the case of it going wrong, to ensure we have everything we need, then we've done everything we need to do. And then it's a case of, is the risk worth it? What's the payoff? But we were never gung-ho.
Do you still feel like you're a risk taker? Has it changed?
No, we're all risk takers.
Yeah, just getting up and walking out the door. But there are some people that will put themselves in, you know, other situations. And I'm not sitting here as somebody who is anti-risk. I think it's how we develop and grow as humans, you know, putting ourselves in situations where I've got, you know, one child who jumps over high things as a sport and the other one who runs into people as a sport, you know. So
that's one way of phrasing both of those career paths. Yeah. Okay.
But so I, you know, so and I've never, would never say to my children, don't do that because it's dangerous, those sports, you know, because it's part of life. But has it changed as you've, I suppose we're talking about middle age, so you know, as you hit middle age, do you think, I don't need to do that, I might not do
I think that.
That
but that's middle age, that's not the experience. That experience is just one of many in my life that go to make me who I am now. I remember early middle age, which to me is sort of 40s, mid 40s, I was presenting a show for BBC, I can't remember the name of it. And that's not because of brain injuries, because I'm 54. But it was quite a big blue chip doc, you know, really big posh thing. And there was one scene that called for me to... There was a massive spider on a web. It was one of those that weave, that their web is used for. It's used for, it doesn't matter. So it was on the web. I mean, it was about this big. And I had to capture it. And that like, special cup, and I'm on this... It was in a greenhouse on top of a university building, so it's warm, and there's this huge spider on this web. And the idea was I'd put my hand behind the spider web and the spider in front of me, then I'd put a cup over the spider. I am not good with spiders, never have been. And after about 10 attempts, I go, no. Well, they're not particularly poisonous, it's not going to kill me, it's a whacking great spider. And no. In the end, I suddenly thought, and I just gave it over to the director, said, mate, I'm 44. That's a whacking great spider. It's not going to kill me, but I don't like spiders. There was a time when I was younger, I needed the money. I would have done it. I don't. You do it. I just bailed. And it was quite a key moment for me. It's the first moment when I realised, yeah, you can change your priorities a little bit. There was a time when I would have, oh, yeah, I've got to do it or they'll think less of me and I won't get any more work. At that moment, I just thought, oh, sod it, you do it. I don't like spiders. I was quite pleased.
Do you miss driving fast, though?
And having I still do get to it.
The adrenaline rush.
Yeah, I'm about to start doing some more. I'm going to do a bit of racing in our little racing car. I ran a classic car restoration business called The Smallest Cog, and I make a little TV show about it. And we did some racing last year, but I didn't drive because I thought I was being grown up. I thought I'd be team manager. And then I thought, yeah, but you have all the fun driving. So I'm going to do a little bit of race driving. But
and how does Mindy feel about that?
I'm not a racing driver, by the way. I can drive for camera, sort of slither it about and then do it again when it goes wrong and they make it look good on telly. But I'm not a racing driver. Mindy's fine with it. I mean, Mindy and the girls are used to it.
But they went through a lot, I imagine, that, you know, that was a hard thing for a family to go through.
Yeah, it was a terrible moment on the second big accident I had in Switzerland when I went off a Swiss Alp because I went over the finish line too fast.
I think Jeremy Clarkson said that was the worst accident he'd ever seen.
It was horrific. I fell some like 400 feet or something down a mountain. So the car flipped end over end over end over end and landed upside down. I was hanging from the seat belt. I did have a crash helmet on, upside down, thinking, oh, that hurt. And then I thought, I better get out. And I struggled. I've got my hand caught under the seatbelt by my watch. And then I thought, no, somebody will come along in a minute and get me out. And then I heard the flames start and I thought, well, I really should get out now. So I actually had to take my watch off to get the hand out of the seatbelt. And then the door did open, even though the car was upside down. Two blokes arrived and I just said, pull me by my arms, my legs are broken. And they strapped me to a spine board by the helicopter. By now, the car's burning white hot. And I thought, God, I've got to call Mindy because this is going to get on social media and she's going to see it and be worried. So I ran a sort of systems check on my head. They must have thought I had gone nuts, but I was lying there saying out loud, right, I'm Richard Hammond, I'm age, whatever I am, I'm in whatever country I'm in. And just checking my brain was still working this time. And when I realised it was, I asked for a telephone and I had to ring Mindy. And she answered, she was shoe shopping with Izzy. Hi, Mind. Now, you're going to see this pretty soon on the internet, so I might as well tell you, I've had another shunt. It's nothing big, nothing broken that won't mend, legs and ribs and things, but head's absolutely fine. I'm okay. They're taking me off to hospital, and I'll call you from there. And then they shot and stuffed me in the helicopter, and off I went to hospital. Shortly after which, James May turned up with a bottle of gin. It was superb.
But you didn't lose consciousness the second time.
No.
Yeah.
No.
The first time you were 2 weeks?
Coma, yeah.
Coma. Mm. So they were very different experiences. You were much more present in your early recovery in the second.
I enjoyed it. I was in a beautiful hospital bed in Switzerland. They didn't want to fly me home because the Swiss are kind of good at mending broken bones. They get a lot of them with the skiing. And they're also very good at making things, so they screwed my knee together. So I had a couple of joyous weeks there.
Yeah, you smashed your patella, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that all good now? Have you got full joint movement as well?
Yeah, full movement, but there is still a plate and 13 bolts in there, which they don't want to take out because it's quite a lot.
So you really do beep through security.
No, do you know, it doesn't.
Really?
I'm really disappointed because
I've got one screw in an ACL and I beat with that.
No, well, this has got 13 through this knee and a big plate about so big down the side of it. And I'm always ready to say, that's just my heroic accident, don't worry. And it never beeps. They didn't. They could have replaced the knee, but I like running and they don't last that long.
Might you need a new knee at some point?
Oh, yeah, it's going arthritic now because I lost a bit of meniscus and a bit of cartilage. And
right. Are you putting that off?
Yeah, because I want to put it off until I know that's
totally
my last
gone.
Knee. I don't want a second
knee. You don't want a second knee?
Because
new knee.
Yeah, exactly right, because they bond it in, don't they? And
it's
taking that out, the next one.
This is the first knee replacement conversation I've had in 100 episodes of The Midpoint. So thank you, Richard.
Well, to be fair, I was the soon after I was back up on my feet, as I was on crutches for months and months and months, I couldn't run, and I've always run. For my mind, more than that. I've never run competitively, but I've always did 5, 10, 15 miles, not marathons or anything, just on my own to escape. And there's a hill opposite me where I've always run for the last 15 years. And I'd always thought, well, I will still be running that when I'm 75, because you can, people do. And I was walking down the road to walk it, because I couldn't yet run on this knee, up the hill. And there's a lovely bloke lives down the road, walks his dog a lot, and he was trotting back in his shorts and his trainers without his dog. And I was saying to him, oh, that's, he said, how are you doing? Oh, yes, it's a bit, they told me I'm not allowed to run on it. And that's a disappointment because I wanted to still be running that hill when I was 75. And he said, yeah, I am 75 today and I just have. So that's when I decided, right, well, I'm
going to get back running.
Yeah, there's no point not running and to save the knee, because then by what's 75, I'd be so unhappy. What's the point? My knee works, but I'm miserable. So what's the point? So I'm going to wear it out.
So running is a big part of your fitness regime, is it?
Yeah, running.
Is it the only thing physically that you like to do?
No, I love strength training, but again, not to be, but just because it's good for the bones. At 54, you can really feel it. And actually, weirdly, you might know the answer to this. I don't know why it happens. If I don't, like this week has been chaos, a lot of early starts, a lot of travelling to and from London. Time was, I'd simply get up an hour or so earlier and go to the gym, but couldn't be bothered. So I haven't been. I always start to get real profound aches and pains to my arms and shoulders if I don't go to the gym. The only way to solve it is I go into the gym, and I'm not. I'm messing about with dumbbells and just light strength training and put myself through it, and then it doesn't hurt anymore.
That's kind of how I'm framing it for myself, why I keep doing it, as well as feeling just good and having got energy, haven't you?
I will... Few rules. If I'm wanting to exercise the next day, lay your kit out the night before.
Yeah, with you on that.
Bed. Yeah. It's absolutely laid out there. So literally I could fall out. I've got no choice. It's there as a reminder. Because what I need to do is get that on, get downstairs, make a coffee, a strong espresso, sit there and keep telling myself, no, you don't want to do it. And you cannot sit here and kill so much time that you've no longer got time. Because you know, in 45 minutes, you're going to walk out of that little room. And it's a gym. There's a bench, a set of those adjustable dumbbells, which is superb, kettlebell and a barbell. In there, 45 minutes later, you are going to leave feeling $1 million. And you'll miss out and your aches and pains will disappear. I've got another... I'm not remotely medical or I don't know anything about anything. But if you do stuff... like running, strength training, sports. I've never competed in anything in my life, physical. Completely amateurish level. You will occasionally scrape, scratch, bump yourself, wrench something, knock a bit of skin off, whatever. I'm sure that better equips your body and your body is better prepared for the business of repair.
Healing, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I have... There's a friend I know. His name starts with J and ends with Ames May. his theory years ago, he used to tell me we'd be travelling the world working, and you know, if call time was 7 in the morning, I'd have to be up at 5:30 because I would go, if we were in a hotel, I'd go and use the gym. If we weren't in a hotel, I'd go for a run. And his theory, and they'd joke about it in the bar that night, the exercise makes you stupid. But my theory was always it prepared more than anything else. More than the immediate fitness and feel good and endorphins, it makes your body used to the business of repair. So that when we've had accidents, I fell off a horse in Vietnam, broke my wrist. Andy Wilman made me carry on driving my truck across Burma, rather, for 2 weeks with a busted wrist, to pretend it wasn't. James fell off a horse in Patagonia, I think it was. Very similar. But it had a bigger effect and took longer to get better. And I talked to him about this, so he won't mind me saying it. Because I do think if your body is used to healing scratches and bruises and wrenches and twinges and bumps, it'll do so better. And if you neglect that, your body is left thinking, broken. What do I do?
You often hear, don't you, people talking about somebody who's got an illness, or you know, maybe they've had a diagnosis of something like cancer, and they say, well, she's really fit and well and she trains and she's exercises, so she will respond well to treatment. And that's not with all cancers or with all diseases and illnesses, but as we get older, obviously the thing about getting old is falls, isn't it? You know, people, when they get old and they have a fall, sometimes they don't come back from it because their body just then, you know, can't repair itself. And so I've had a lot of people on this podcast who've said, in medical people, basically the reason why you keep training is because, first of all, you're less likely to have a fall because your balance will be better and your body will understand those sudden movements better because of its muscular strength. But also you're more likely to recover quicker from those things if you're fit and strong. So I don't even need to deep dive into the science of it. That's enough for me. I kind of feel like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And I'm happy with that because you want to be able to face what's coming in the best shape you can, rather than feel like you're going to have to succumb to something.
Because it is coming.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I think also
it's coming down the track.
You mentioned balance. A lot of my time in the gym, because you read enough, especially if you're middle-aged and wake up and can't sleep. You read enough about the profound nature of balance, actually, because there's microscopic adjustments, connection with brain. It's good for us in every single way. So I always make sure to include a lot of stuff, a lot of one-legged dips and stuff.
Just even brushing your teeth on one balance. Leg yeah. is good. Brush your teeth on one leg.
But you can feel it doing good because that's when I most feel the connection between mind and body. Mm. If I'm doing any exercise it doesn't have to be particularly strenuous or fast or explosive or repetitive, but balance, you can feel it doing you good. And your body is saying thank you.
I do a lot of Pilates where you adjust all the time and you're more aware on one leg about adjusting your hips. If somebody says to you, square your hips off, that doesn't mean anything until you're suddenly on one leg leaning forwards and then you understand
what squaring
your hips off means. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we know your balance is good. And enjoying, which you can see though, just from you talking, that you get that endorphin rush from doing some exercise as well. And you feel good after it. So it keeps you going back, doesn't it? Which is, and you realize that your energy levels, like this week, like you were saying, I had a similar one a few weeks ago where normally I would always try and make space, and that week I did two sessions as opposed to five or something, and kind of forgave myself for it because I was so busy, but I knew I just wasn't quite as sharp and happy as, you know, I was succumbing a bit more to tiredness or a bit of stress than I would. And that's the bit that exercise definitely helps me with.
I think you're also doing something else when you make that time for it, which is you're telling the world your day ahead. Yeah, but this thing matters. This, me. Even if nobody else is going to look after you for the rest of the day or week, nobody else is going to do anything for you, you can look after you. And then it's you that faces that week. And you've got to engage with people and you've got to be there as your best self. And the best thing you can do is look after yourself. And if that is, it doesn't have to be a lot. Make half an hour in the morning. Go for a brisk walk. I'm not talking about sweating it out for an hour and a half with a personal trainer in a gym. I'm talking about just telling yourself and telling the world that you matter enough to warrant a little bit of maintenance and care is a really important thing. And I think especially in midlife, as let's be honest, there's quite a lot of demands. If you're lucky enough to have children, they have demands, even if without saying anything, because you must think about them and consider them and what they're doing wherever they are. There's work, there's maybe your own parents. There's a million things to think about. Somebody's got to care about you. Might as well be you.
And you'll be better at doing all those different jobs if you've looked after a bit of you.
Yeah.
Those relationships and those trips, those friendships, those big kind of, you know, those bonding moments that you must have had, where do you get those from now that you guys aren't doing that together regularly? And you the grand tour's finished, hasn't it now? Is that right?
We're probably going to, yeah. I mean, it's been a
but you're not years. You're not in that weekly or that kind of
no, we haven't done that for a while.
Yeah, no, exactly. So do you have other people that are in your lives for that?
Yeah, I've got lots of friends going right the way back to when I started radio in 1988, but also newer and more recent friends.
And you make sure that you keep that kind of, you know, because a lot of men, you talked about before about how men are much more likely to chat now about their problems and their issues, but also I think men in the past perhaps let those groups slide a bit, didn't they?
Yeah.
And maybe didn't have those.
You have to make a conscious effort. I've never been particularly good at it because I was lucky enough to have that happen automatically through work.
It's kind of there on the plate for you.
You're absolutely right. It was just done for me. But I do now. So I live out in Herefordshire, very rural, fairly sparsely populated county. So my local friends, it's far enough from London that it's its own place. So my local friends are not all bankers and television people, which... Nothing wrong with bankers and television people, but I don't want to just know them. So my group of friends are, what are we? A farmer, another farmer, a builder, a helicopter pilot, a man who works in the car industry. But so we're just a mix of blokes, but we're mates. And we make a conscious effort. I missed it this week. It's a Thursday night in a local pub. I was in London. I got a lot of grief on our WhatsApp group for it. But we make a conscious effort. And we're fairly overt about it. It's therapy.
Mm.
And it really is. I think a lot of men already do stuff that's good for their mental health and well-being without even being aware of it. I think what I'd like to do more of in future series of the podcast is actually look for that. Because if you go to the pub with your mates and you get stuff off your chest, you are actually doing really good work. If you do it a little bit more mindfully, you'll amplify the effect of it. It'll be more effective. Downloading with your mates, sitting and letting your mate download is as good for you as for him. and you're providing a service for him.
And you don't always have an answer or a solution.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Just being present while that happens is good for you. I mean, it has been, there is empirical data and evidence to prove that it is good for men to hang around with men. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Just occasionally.
It's really
just
important.
There's a lot of unspoken stuff. Just sitting with a mate, he tells you a story. Well, years ago, and he won't mind me sharing it because I've shared it before and he knows it happened. One of my oldest friends, Les, who's a shepherd up in the Lake District, I've known him since I was 17, so that's 37 years.
that's 2 17s.
Yeah, it is. It's too long. He and I were up in the Lake District on a fell side watching the Lakeland Vintage Trial, where a load of vintage cars drive up over. It's a stupid activity. I've done it. It's brilliant. We were standing there lashing Lakeland rain, watching the cars go past. And a little bloke came up, same sort of height as us. And I thought immediately, oh, you're another Lakeland farmer because they tend to be built along similar lines. And he came up, obviously knew Les. He'd known the family for years, called Craig. How do? You're right then, Les. All right. Another pause, more rain came past. How's your dad then, Les? More rain came past. Les said, oh, he's had to go into a home in Cockermouth. Oh, more rain came past. Buggered, is he? More rain. Aye. That was it. That was a total conversation. So after we were sheltering in the pub, me and Les, I said, mate, that was a bit, you know, you and Craig, that was a bit Spartan as a conversation. And he said, no, I know he loved me, Dad. He's known him for 50 years. He didn't have to say it. I know he's going to be sad that he's dying, but he didn't have to say it. And I thought, oh, yeah. And that was a kind of, they both knew that knew. About mm. one another. So they didn't have to share it. But they were sharing a moment. And I think if you're in the pub with your mates and your mate is moaning about whatever, doesn't matter, work, his favourite team, home, whatever, that business of him getting it off his chest, knowing he can, knowing he's with people who empathise or sympathise, who've got his back, you don't have to do anything else. You don't have to offer a solution. And in fact, by listening, you're providing a service to him. And by you providing that service to him, you are providing a service to yourself also. So everybody wins in that encounter. And I'd like to highlight more how we're all doing that already. And if we just switch it on a bit more mindfully, it'll be more effective.
I do think as well, though, some people, and you and I are lucky because we've got jobs which mean we meet new people, different people all the time, and we get stimulated by that. We hear different ideas. And I have noticed as post-COVID, definitely, there are people who haven't quite got back out there yet socially, you know, and it feels like a lot of people have reverted to maybe an inner hermit that might have liked that idea before and was forced to kind of go out because that's what we all did. We didn't socialize on our own really at home. We did go out. And I think some people have found it hard to get back out and have conversations.
That's a really good point. Yes, quite possibly. And we are being in some instances, disincentivized from doing so. I mean, there's plenty of work that isn't demanding that you leave your house and go to work anymore. And which of us would actually say, no, I'm going to? If you're given the option of staying at home near your own kettle and your own cat, you're going to. But you're right. Those chance encounters, they were not without meaning and use. And we are social animals. It's only because we're social animals that we've been enabled to proliferate and exist in such vast numbers and at such density. It's the social nature of us that explains our existence. And if we neglect it, it can only be damaging. Yeah, I think it's really important.
I think in midlife, you can get comfy and it can, you know, can be easy to say no to something. And there's a beauty in that, don't get me wrong.
Oh, I
mean, you know, there's an absolute
it.
Joy
it's
in saying no to certain things. But there's also sometimes you go, no. I'm going to go to that, actually, because that could be a really fun evening, or I'm going to meet somebody there that is a bit different to my normal crowd, or, you know, and I think it's still important to try and push yourself into those slightly
yes.
uncomfortable social situations.
So sometimes you should catch the spider. I think you're absolutely right.
That could be the name of your next podcast.
Catch
the spider.
Because I think there's maybe a danger sometimes, you're absolutely right, that we think, no, I've earned the right. Andy Wilman always used to say when we were doing Top Gear, look, he'd go into the bosses for another shouting out and he'd just say, look, I'm 46, I can't be in trouble anymore. And he was kind of right. But sometimes you have to push yourself. It's weird, but I mean, I would still push myself to go for a run. I'm working tomorrow, but I'll get home to Herefordshire tomorrow night. And I know Sunday, in my mind, it's quite easy. I'll do the double. So I'll get up and I'll hit the gym and then I'll run 8 miles around the hill. Now, I know Sunday morning I'm going to be procrastinating and thinking of excuses. Oh, well, I haven't seen home for a while. I said, No, come on, Rich, do it.
The rest of Sunday will be so much better for it.
Yeah, but I think socially, I suspect my midlife, if you're lucky enough to have always pursued some sort of physical activity that you've taken with you into midlife, then it's fairly easy to continue pushing yourself to do that. But if you've always pushed yourself socially to do stuff and it's tiring and it's anxiety inducing and it's difficult and you get to midlife and you think, I don't have to do that anymore, I think you're right. I think you do. So I think we should push ourselves. Oh, no, I'm going to have to push myself socially.
Learning something as well. I think that new skill or a new, some kind of new hobby, I think is really important.
But it sounds like every cliche around middle age is true.
It is true.
It's there
it
for
is
a reason.
True. But there's loads of great stuff, you know, and we've all got a little bit more wisdom and knowledge, and we've got a little bit more confidence, hopefully a lot more confidence than perhaps we did in our... We had confidence in our 20s, but it was perhaps slightly misplaced.
Entirely. Can I put my hand up then and confess? I feel like this is the appropriate place to get it off my chest. In middle age lately, because I'm, 54, I'm steaming through middle age. I'm not young middle age anymore.
It's your first rodeo.
Getting on with this. And I thought the time was right. So, I mean, I've learned to be much better at giving myself those moments. So I would never in the past, a Sunday now for me, I'll get up and maybe go to the gym or go for, sometimes now I will run to the paper shop because it's a perfect, it's 3 miles away. Perfection, trot down to the paper shop, buy the newspapers, stick them in a rucksack, trot back, Sunday papers, coffee. But I will then sit with that coffee and the papers for an hour and I'll do the crosswords and I'll do the Sudoku. And I would never have done that as a younger bloke. So I'm loving giving, but I've gone a step further than that. At the age of 54, I've taken up modelling, and I don't mean being photographed.
Are you talking the Rod Stewart?
No, I'm talking making models. I'm building an Airfix Spitfire.
Oh, okay.
I'm loving it. It's brilliant.
Rod Stewart does that with train sets, doesn't he? He builds model villages.
Right. Here's the point. It's because it's an entirely... It is without any discernible point. There is no win. There is no nothing at all. What have you achieved? I've made a smaller version, a not very convincing smaller version of something that exists at a much bigger scale. But it's completely absorbing and you can find yourself in that, they call it flow state. The pointlessness of it is the point because you're not going to judge yourself by the results. You'd like to do it well, but it doesn't really matter if you don't. I mean, I do like drawing, I like painting.
Do you have a little model room? Yeah. Is it all laid out?
Stop it. Nobody needs to know that. I'm not going there. I'm confessing it.
And is it just Sundays, Richard?
Yeah.
Just Sundays.
The other thing I've discovered is you cannot do it whilst you've got a drink in your hand. Or even I cannot have a gin and tonic whilst doing it because it'll be a disaster. Yeah. So
it puts off the afternoon.
Well, given that I have absolutely no handbrake whatsoever, it stops me setting off. It's because I'll think, it'll be Sunday, early evening, and I think, time for a little sniff. Because I'm going to do a bit of that model. Oh, I won't have that.
That's very...
Then I lose myself.
Useful handbrake. So where are you with alcohol for the rest of the week?
I don't have any strict rules.
No, so you're just as and when you're a kind of...
Yeah.
But you know, you said you've got no handbrake. You know your limitations with work, though. Like, you know what you're going to feel
like. I cannot work if I even touch it. Yeah. We always had that on Top Gear, Grand Tour, and every other TV show I've ever done, because we used to do live stage shows. So we'd tour the world for 10 years, playing, and we'd 20, 30, 40, 50,000-seater stadiums, us three idiots going out, doing handbrake turns and talking. That's ridiculous. But the one thing we knew, and we never broke the rule, we couldn't do it after even half a beer. We just cannot do that. We can't speak. We can't coordinate.
Even
just,
Jeremy.
None of us could.
Because when I was on Millionaire with him, he said to me, because I was procrastinating about an answer, and it was nearly 5 o'clock, and he went, hurry up, it's nearly rosé o'clock.
We see, that's because the only danger, because I know he's done the same as me, and I know I've done this, because we would never touch a drop.
So he wanted me to finish so he could go.
If you're near a car, obviously you can't touch a drop. No. But if you're going out on stage, plenty of people do. We knew the moment we touch, I can't speak, I'm a gibbering idiot. If he does something funny, I can't find the line to say something about it. It won't work. So we never did. What that means is, as soon as you finish work, we used to make it a race to get first to a beer. So we'd say goodbye, and there's like 20,000, 30,000 people, bye, and then we'd get backstage straight to a beer.
And that's why your running came in really handy.
The best that ever happened is as we'd say bye, everybody. I think we're in South Africa, Moscow, I don't know. We turned around, and as we turned around to walk off the stage, Jeremy went like that and pulled out of his inside pocket a beer. Oh, come on, you haven't even got off the stage. The problem there is it associates in your mind having a drink with not working. Because if I've got a drink in my hand, I know definitively I'm not working. I can't be, because I've got a drink in my hand, and I would never, I can't work with a drink in my hand. What that means is, on a weekend, I want to prove to myself I'm not working, and the only way to really do that
is to have a drink.
which is why those modern alcohol-free beers have saved my life, because I get to Saturday lunchtime and I need definitive empirical evidence to myself that I'm not working.
It's almost like your inner student or something.
So if I've got a beer, I can't be working, but I can have an alcohol-free beer. My idiot brain thinks, well, it's a beer, isn't it? You can't be working. You can relax and have a nice time, and I'll have a couple of those, and then I'm fine.
And obviously, the new Top Gear lineup that came down, and now the show has gone, sadly, because of what's happened to Andrew Flintoff, and it doesn't appear to be coming back ever. When that happened, what did you feel?
I'm asked about it a lot. I don't have much more to say than I don't know anything more than anybody else knows about it. I felt sad.
Did it ring lots of memories for you, though, because of what had happened to you?
With the accident. Yeah. I mean, I just feel terribly sorry for him. It sounds like it was a hideous experience. I don't know any more than anybody else, and I can only wish him all the very, very best in what, for anybody having gone through anything like that, is going to be a long road to recovery, and I really do. My heart goes out to him and to the team, because, you know, they're a good bunch. As for the show, to be fair, it's been parked before. Mm. I used to watch as a kid. Jeremy was on it. James was on it. Then it was parked. And then we brought it back in a different shape. Now it's been parked again, and probably rightly so. And then it will come back again. I mean, there's never been a time more ripe for an old-fashioned, quite serious magazine show discussing cars, because they are undergoing massive change for the necessary and inevitable decarbonisation of the transport infrastructure. And we each have a role to play in that, because our cars are our second biggest purchase after a house, if we're lucky enough to be able to buy one. And therefore, we should be better informed than we are. So somebody needs to make a show about that, and it should probably be the BBC. So it'll come back, of course it will.
Would you want to be part of it?
Probably wouldn't be right, would it? Because I've been on a different version of it, and that the time for that has gone. So, no, I think it needs a fresh start. I think they need to say, right, forget about everything, that one incarnation of a long-running TV show. Let's have another version of it. It might be a bit serious for a few years, and then it might go away and come back again as something. Maybe as things change in transport, maybe it'll polarise out into you press your smartphone button and an autonomous, anonymous box turns up that delivers you to where you want to go, and that's brilliant. But when that happens, I think a lot of people will think, yes, but I really felt something for that machine that moved me physically, because it moved me emotionally, because it afforded me everything I needed in my life beyond shelter.
Well, who doesn't have a story about their first car? You know, have that,
because they represent, yeah, because they move you physically. Everything you need beyond shelter, your cave provides you shelter, but as soon as you need a mate, friendship, food, resources, water, anything, you've got to leave your cave and go and get it, which is why humans invented the car. It's a machine that does that, so it enables your life. It was also inevitable, of course, that no sooner had we invented it than we thought, well, I reckon my machine can get me to whatever it is that I need quicker than the one next door. So we invented racing them. What do they say? I think motor racing car racing began the day there were two cars, and it did. But yeah, I think those machines are so integral to our lives that our passion for them will never go away. So maybe what we need is a period of quite a serious, educative, informative show dealing with technological advances and how we're going to decarbonize them. But shortly after that, I think we'll rediscover our passion for it. And a lot of people who would never have called themselves car enthusiasts will realize, oh yeah, I kind of am actually, I didn't think I was. And then we'll want to indulge that and engage with it. And we'll do that through a TV show.
Bridget, it seems only right that we finish this chat talking about cars.
I'm so good at it. I really am. So, I could talk about.
I mean, we did an hour before you got there. But,
yeah, I'm that predictable. Boring,
no,
I'm sorry.
And what you said there, I think, was a really brilliant grown-up sentence, actually, that is really important that, you know, people, they're so politicised now, cars, aren't they?
Yeah.
And yet still so integral, especially like we live quite rurally like you. I can't rely on public transport, so we are going to have to come up with answers. Thank you so much for your time and your candor and your honesty, and best of luck with Izzy on the podcast. I'm sure it's going to
thank
be a great success, and hopefully make you an even more informed midlife bloke.
I'd like to, yes, to be a useful
even
contributor.
More.
That's what we all want, definitely.
Yeah. Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed chatting to Richard, a man who's clearly thinking about his midlife self. And it was brilliant what he said about making time for exercise, telling the world that your health and well-being is important. And if you don't look after yourself, who will? And it was interesting to hear his thoughts on what he calls the pale, stale male, or rather his quest to not become one. If you're interested in hearing more about that, do check out his podcast, Who We Are Now. And don't forget to press follow wherever you listen to The Midpoint so that you can always know when a new episode is dropping. Please share this episode with anyone you think will enjoy it as well, so we can reach even more midpointers. So my heartfelt thanks to Richard, to Spiritland Creative, and of course, most importantly, to you for listening. I hope you'll join me again next Wednesday. Bye for now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.